I'm Rob Cohen, and I'm the director of The Fast and the Furious and Triple X, and among other things, the producer of The Running Man. Long before I made it as a director, I was a producer. And in 1985, I took over Vice Chairman, which was the funded by Taft Broadcasting. The first thing I did, the first acquisition I made, was to buy a Richard Bachman novella from a guy I knew named George Linder. I liked it because I had seen in Japan a quiz show called Ultra Quiz, which was really the precursor of reality shows. And this game show was particularly sadistic. They would take contestants and torture them for money, and whoever, you know, cried uncle would lose, and the contestant that could take the pain or the humiliation would win. Sounds a little like today. But back in 85, the idea was thought of as far out, not likely, fantastic. I felt otherwise. So I purchased this novella and a screenplay that was written on it for a very reasonable sum, I think $15,000, and was very delighted to find out a short time thereafter that Richard Bachman was really none other than Stephen King, which gave a great deal of weight to the project from the beginning.
Release point, Echo Bravo 1.
Move in and check it out.
Roger, moving in.
My journey on this particular movie was both sinuous and painful, but it was emblematic of what a producer was able to do in the mid to late 1980s when I made this film. I had five different directors, and there were several major pieces of casting examined and in great discussions, from Patrick Swayze to Christopher Reeve, and finally the choice of Arnold Schwarzenegger as he was rising to the very fine heights that he got to with this picture, one of the steps along his journey. The 80s had a new idea, along with junk bonds and the kind of wildness that was going on in all areas of financial matters. Filmmaking began to have a thing we called separated rights, or essentially divvying up the various aspects of a movie's potential revenue and selling those pieces off. Sounds a lot like the way corporate raiders work. And it was the same kind of model. A movie was worth so much at the box office. If it did so much at the box office, it was worth so much to HBO. If it did so much to HBO, it was worth so much to Vestron for video cassette. This was prior to DVD. And so on. Pay television, free television, foreign and domestic. And you could go to like a film festival like Cannes, and if you had enough elements, you could actually raise the money to make this film prior to ever having made it. And, of course, the ideal was that you would raise enough money to be in profit before the movie actually rolled. That was the dream, and that rarely ever happened. It certainly didn't happen in Running Man, although it looked like it could in the beginning. And as you'll see, this kind of fractionalized filmmaking finance is actually probably more work than making the film itself.
Hey, Charlie, you see the Running Man last night? I never miss it. I even won $500. Lucky bastard. We're cool coming, you. Where's your transfer for both? Okay, hang on. Lenny, this is the...
Having acquired the script and the book, I brought in Stephen D'Souza, who had written Commando and Die Hard, because I knew that Arnold was the guy I wanted, and that D'Souza, having written Commando, had a good relationship with Schwarzenegger, and that would create a great deal of confidence, because the writer is so critical, and Stephen is talented and had the imagination to take the King short story and give it more of a futuristic and wild edge, which we evolved as the script went through some 20 to 25 drafts.
Get out of here. Sonic deadline is up. Sonic deadline is up. Prisoner restraint collars on. Prisoner restraint collars on.
Having seen Rambo 2, the first director that I reached out to was George Pan Cosmatos. I thought Rambo 2 was an extremely effective movie, and in many ways I liked its theatricality better than Rambo 1, which was very well done, very realistic. And again, I figured a director who had handled Sly would be a natural to handle Arnold, because in a sense, very strong leading men, male action stars, have a certain vocabulary between the director and the actor, and if you've done it with one of the great stars, you could do it with another. Cosmatos was very passionate in the beginning, and although in his Greek accent and his kind of chain-smoking craziness, sometimes I couldn't quite follow what he wanted to do, but I signed him, and we started to develop the script. George, having directed the movie that was going to do $200 million with Rambo 2, he had a lot of power to ask that he be given his head with the script. He wanted to stage the entire Running Man in a shopping center in Canada somewhere. And I could never wrap my mind around the idea that these guys would be running, jumping, and diving, and people would be shooting and chasing them in a shopping center, and that would be the whole movie. In one of the more difficult decisions I ever had, I was facing a several million dollar loss for the company if I fired George or replaced him. I spent the day reading Stephen Bach's really insightful look at his part in making Heaven's Gate. After reading the Stephen Bach book, I simply called up George and said, "We don't agree. I don't agree with you. I'm not going to start the picture till the script is ready. I don't like the directions you've taken it in. And so I think we should have a parting of the ways." At this point, D'Souza and I began to think about this movie as a more wild film, not just guys chasing other guys like a hunting party or the most most dangerous game, which was the core of the Stephen King novella, but to get to a place in the future where crime and entertainment and punishment and entertainment had become overlapping, and that audiences would enjoy in the future watching the reality of criminals being hunted down. in order to make that work, since I had already learned that shopping centers were not the place where this could happen, I began to develop the idea that there was a dilapidated zone in the city where this kind of cat and mouse and deadly hunting game could take place, and that the show would in fact have all these live remote cameras, and that the zone would be walled off. So once they were dropped in there, it was a no man's land, free for all. So all the shooting and killing and whatever was to take place could take place without it involving innocent civilians.
A child, your child, happy, loving, caring.
You believe this shit? 24 hours a day,
7 days a week.
Don't listen to it.
I worry about the kids. The network shuts down the schools. The kids are either in hiding or getting basic training, brainwashed by the TV.
We can jam the network once we find the uplink to the satellite. Then we'll broadcast the truth.
Truth hasn't been very popular lately.
Stephen and I were very impacted by the whole robot idea and what would become video game concepts of villains, that villains have kind of gimmicky special powers, whether they use electricity or whether they freeze you to death or whatever, and we wanted to create our own kind of characters in this light, so that the pursuers are not just guys hoisting hunting rifles like in the Stephen King story, but were in fact very colorful guys who are somewhat like heavyweight wrestlers, which was, again, WWF was beginning to make its resurgence, and the idea of extreme physical fitness was beginning to also rise in the mid-80s, part of what thrust Arnold into the heights because of his amazing physical adeptness and developed body.
You got it.
Also, Arnold was great because he had charm. The thing that makes Arnold an eternal movie star is that what he does better than anybody else, and who he is always entertaining to watch. His sense of humor and his sense of being larger than life and not really a true person fit perfectly into this world of madness where a television show which involved the life and death pursuit of criminals would in fact be a good match. And that's part of what producing is assembling elements that really, really fit. The choice of Richard Dawson, who was my sister, Jackie Birch, was the casting director, and not many people know she's my sister, but I used her on this, and she came up with the idea of Richard Dawson, and that, as here is a man who is totally validated as a game show host, who was on television for a decade, and has that wonderfully smarmy, slimy, nasty kind of duality that makes game show hosts the kind of stars that they become in their own right. And if we look at American Idol today, you can see what a nasty host can do to the ratings, and ratings being the primary concern of this side of the movie.
Whoa! Oh, sorry.
Hey, that's all right. Yeah. What's your name?
Van.
Van, you're doing good work. Looks beautiful. Don't worry.
Thank you.
Okay?
Thank you.
Brenda, if that asshole is mopping the floor tomorrow, you'll be mopping it for the rest of the week. Let's go.
I'd seen a German film by a director named Carl Schenkel. It was futuristic, and it was made for a very little money. He was in Hollywood looking for his first American feature. I met with him, thought he would be a good director for this. This also didn't turn out to be a good choice because, in the end, the scale of the picture was larger than what he felt comfortable handling. So I think Carl lasted about a month on the movie as we continued, Stephen and I, to develop the script. And then, by mutual agreement, there was a parting of the ways with him.
Edward?
Damon, were you down in wardrobe yet? They've got your new jackets. They're fantastic.
Who chose the colors?
Hey, how are my people today?
Fine, sir. Thank you.
You're looking good. Love that uniform. Tony! What do you got for
Damon,
me?
Damon, thank God. The Justice Department's calling every 10 minutes.
Just give them an evasive answer. Tell them go fuck themselves.
Got my coffee? I want to know what we got, all right?
All right.
I was getting increasingly nervous because I had Arnold interested, depending on the director. I had Stephen writing. We had money being spent trying to figure out how to do it. And I really believed this was a very commercial film if I could get it together.
If the answer is yes, then you're ready for Captain Freedom's workout.
Yes, it's America's own Captain Freedom, 10-time national champion.
At this time, I went to Cannes with this film, with The Running Man, with Arnold's agreement that it could be sold that way, with really no director to speak of, and the idea of it was a Stephen King novella. And that year in Cannes, I was able to raise about $18 million for the film using this fractionalization of rights technique, so much from HBO, so much from France, so much from Italy, so much from England for the theatrical, you know, rights. And we had a deal that we constructed with TriStar to distribute the movie in the United States. So, with a budget of $16 million and having $18 million in the bank, it looked like we could start The Running Man in a profitable position. And the money that had been spent getting from Cosmatos to Schenkel and then to English director named Ferdinand Fairfax seemed to be on the verge of paying off.
Glamorous people in a fabulous place. So, when you hear the tone, control your agility and leave your
image.
Kenzie, I'm a Fisher,
babyface
March.
Unfortunately, Ferdy went off without anyone knowing or asking him, and he came back, and he was gone for several weeks where I couldn't find him. And he called me, and he goes, I've solved everything. I know how the movie should work, and I've written the treatment. And the minute I heard he had written a treatment, when I had spent hundreds of thousands of dollars and months with Stephen D'Souza, I began to get a bad feeling. And sure enough, he came to see me, he handed me a 25-page treatment and said, this is the movie I'm going to make, this is just the greatest, you're going to love it, it's everything it should be. Well, of course, it was everything it shouldn't have been. And when a director goes so on the line with a vision that that's what he really wants to do, and you read it and you think, this is nothing that I want to do. Not only that, he had written it into a thing that was so expensive and futuristic as to have no relevance anymore, and I was much more interested in keeping it in the William Gibson cyberpunk genre. And I had no recourse at this point but to say, I don't agree with you. And he says, well, I don't agree with you. So we once again respectfully agreed to disagree. So that was the third director down.
What is this?
That's my synthesizer setup. I'm a musician.
I had seen Under Siege, and Arnold and I had talked about Andy Davis, who I had known distantly through the years since he came out from Chicago. I thought he was a talented filmmaker, but a guy who had a lot of trouble making up his mind. But Arnold really wanted Andy, and I think the way Andy directed Steven Seagal in Under Siege was very influential on Arnold, because Seagal really gave in that film the best performance of his career, and Andy, being the director, is due a lot of credit for that. And so we made a deal with Andy Davis, and this, he lasted the longest in the pre-production phase of the movie. In fact, he got to shoot 8 days of the film before, as you'll see, more crises ensued.
Maybe someplace warm. I need to work on my tan anyway. See, you get so pale in prison.
There you are.
Good. Andy and Arnold began to form up a tight unit unto themselves, which is often the case. And as the producer, I had to sort of let the baby go a bit, because a director of some substance and talent and who had the trust of the star was now at the helm, and that was okay with me, and I tried to back up to a place where I could let the creative elements involved do their thing. And but I insisted that we keep Steve D'Souza so that there would be a continuity of the writing and of the vision of the picture.
So why don't you just forget about all this and turn yourself in?
You know, it's a very negative attitude.
Andy started to fool with the script, and D'Souza, you know, worked on the ideas that we all agreed were better, and we held the line in places where it wasn't better. But there was no doubt that the movie was getting better.
She put my credit card in, then we couldn't find them for a week. Oh, yeah, could you hold this, please?
Want to move it up there? We got a plane to catch.
I brought Jackie Birch on. We began to cast. We got Yaphet Kotto and other actors to, you know, fill out the cast. Maria Conchita Alonso, and began to look at the cost of a movie that was constantly being rewritten and constantly changing. And no surprise, but the costs were beginning to escalate quite alarmingly. And within a month of Andy coming on the picture, we went from being $2 million in profit to being about $2 million in the hole, which meant that the budget had gone up $4 million in the first month. This was very troubling, and I consulted on an hourly basis with Tim Zinnemann, who had produced my first film as a director, A Small Circle of Friends, who I'd brought in as a line producer. The biggest problem that I had with Andy was that he could not make up his mind, and as the start date approached, because with stars the size of Arnold, you give him a date on which you're going to start shooting, and essentially, you've made a deal for those 14 weeks, and if you're not ready, that's not their problem, and they will start the clock when it's supposed to start and charge you a pro rata amount, which is horrendous, for the weeks that you then run over on the other end. So it became imperative that we get this production fully together.
You know who I am?
I've seen you before.
As this pressure mounted, Andy's lack of ability to make a decision became more and more treacherous and troublesome. We couldn't decide on locations. In one of the most memorable meetings of all, we were unable to decide on the Running Man costumes, and when you watch the movie, you realize that Arnold and Yoffit and the others are in these costumes the entire film. So whatever we chose, whatever we designed, was going to have to truly be right, because that was it. That was the look. Well, getting that costume design was proving to be impossible, and we had to manufacture, you know, multiple copies because of all the running and jumping and diving and stunts and stunt doubles and all that. And our start date was approaching, and Andy could not decide on what the costume should be. So I called a meeting, and we had, with the costume designer, probably 40 or 50 variations on what the running man uniform would look like. I said to Andy, we are going to decide in this room right now what that costume's going to be. So here are the 50 versions you've evolved, and now it's time to decide which material, what color, what are the shoulders like, what are the legs like, and we're going to break it down, and we're going to draw it right here with the costume people. And Tim Zinnemann was there, we were all there, and when we leave this room, we're all going to sign the drawing and say, this is in fact the costume. And he agreed, and we spent the day picking legs and shoulders and knee pads and shoes and materials and colors and all the things that would go into the costume. When it was drawn up and all the swatches and bits of detail were attached to the drawing, he signed it, I signed it, Tim Zinnemann signed it, and I left the production offices and drove back to Century City, where the Taft Barish offices were, and my office. By the time I made that drive, which was no more than 25 minutes, I got a call from Tim Zinnemann telling me that Andy had snuck back into the wardrobe department and was changing the designs again, and that we still couldn't go into manufacture of the costumes, and that this would mean overtime and, perhaps even a delay in the start of shooting. This was the sort of final straw for me in terms of knowing that I did not think Andy would survive the course of the movie. So I talked to Andrea Eastman, an agent at ICM, about Paul Michael Glaser. Now, Paul Michael Glaser, who you know primarily from Starsky and Hutch as an actor, was a very fine director on the first year of Miami Vice, which I was also. So I knew him from our work creating the phenomenon of Miami Vice, and I thought his episode of Smuggler's Blues was truly stylish, and he showed an enormous command of, you know, glitzy visuals, and as an actor himself, I think he had a good language to communicate with Arnold and the other actors. I did not tell Andre Eastman, his agent, what I was talking about, but I kept saying, do not let Paul Michael Glaser take a job. I have a major feature. It's coming together. And before you do anything, please contact me so that I might, you know, act preemptively, but I'm not quite there yet.
It's time.
In the meantime, Zinnemann and I did everything we could to prepare Andy for the start of shooting. And that day finally arrived, and we went out to the Fontana steel mills to shoot the opening prison sequence with the exploding, you know, C4 necklaces for a prison without walls, and the introduction of the context of the show, when we felt, okay, we finally made it to the start mark. By this point, the running man had gone from $16 to $25 million. Now, if you're a major studio and you have unlimited bank credit and you can just get dial up the money if you need it, this would already be an alarming crisis for a film to go 50% over budget by the time it was 8 days into shooting. But when you're an independent company, when you've raised the money through foreign pre-sales, etc., and there's no more money to get, you cannot go back to the distributor in France and go, I know we made a deal for $1 million, but now I need $1.8 million, you know. It doesn't happen. You have a contract, you're to deliver the film, they're to pay you so much for that negative. I was really losing sleep when I got a call at 6 o'clock in the morning from the editor. And I might add, this was Andy's editor. It is not mine. And Mark said to me, I don't know how to tell you this, but I've been trying to cut the sequences together, and they don't cut. He's done 60 setups on Arnold and team entering the skating rink sequence, but I don't know how to cut it together. It just doesn't go together, and you should know it. Well, that was it for me. We were now $8 million over budget, 8 days behind, 4 days behind schedule after 8 days of shooting. I had no belief that it was going to get any better, and even the footage we shot wasn't going to cut together. So I talked to Keith Barish and the others involved and felt that we had to change again.
We'll rape you and kill you. We'll kill you then rape you. You mean a guy like that? What would stop him?
What would? Look, Amy, I have to pass on that drink. I just remember that I have some paperwork to do, so I'll catch you tomorrow.
The producer of The Running Man and everyone's favorite showman.
The problem, of course, was that there was a relationship now between Arnold and Andy, and that Arnold would have to agree to any movement that I made because, as the star, he has an enormous amount of power, and it was important that he not lose belief in the project, or that we not be one of those disasters that end up in nothing but lawsuits.
Showtime!
I called Arnold and I said we were on night shoots and I'd like very much to have breakfast with him. So we met out in Venice and I told him the story. I told him what was going on and pointed out that as a gross profit participation, this kind of over-budget thing was going to impact him personally, and that I didn't believe that the movie that was coming out was going to be worthy of the potential.
You're great at your job. Too bad it isn't music.
He was very angry at me. He felt, I think, that I wanted to direct the movie myself, which is not really true. And he felt that perhaps I had interfered too much in Andy's process and so on. And he said as much. But I stood my ground and I said, that may be true or not true. That we can debate for the ages. What we can't debate is the over budget, the behind schedule, and the lack of a clear vision of the film. And he said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, I want you to look at this episode of Miami Vice called Smuggler's Blues, and I want to bring in Paul Michael Glaser, who is a shooter and who is an actor who I think you're going to very much like, and I would really like it to happen tonight. He had high hopes for this relationship to work, but I felt that in the end, this would be, my decision would be justified. And although I really wanted his respect, if not friendship, it was more important to me that a year from now, when the film came out, he would look and say that was the right decision.
Civilians moving in.
Yankee 9-9er, the crowd is unarmed. Repeat, unarmed. Abort attempt. Acknowledge Yankee 9-9er.
The hell with you.
Lieutenant Sanders, take command. Detain Richards and return to base. Acknowledge Yankee 9-9er. Acknowledge. Return to base. Those are innocent, unarmed people down there. Cease fire. Cease fire.
I pulled the trigger on Paul Michael Glazer, bringing him in, and I told Andy that he would be terminated, and we were in the rights of our contract because of the over budget and the behind schedule, and he took it in a very gentlemanly fashion, and we settled out his contract, and that night I guided Paul Michael Glazer onto the set and introduced him to Arnold and to all of the key people on the film.
A Bakersfield!
Paul, being a very veteran television director, knew just how to step in, take charge of the crew, and start to shoot the movie. And from the minute he came in, the film started to flow, schedules were met, shots were cool, stuff started to happen, and the resources that we had made available to this film were being used in a very efficient and intelligent manner. And we began to settle down and make the movie. In the end, the karma of all this, and yet again part of the 80s story, is that I no longer wanted to have a partnership with Keith Barish. I found it a very uncomfortable working relationship, and at the end of my two-year contract, for a host of reasons involving Ironweed and other movies that we were doing, it was clear that we were not going to proceed as partners any longer. And in a very interesting power play, Keith bonded with Tim Zinnemann, and basically at the end of my two-year tenure at Taft Barish, they had a kind of palace coup. I was out, my office was locked, and the picture was in post-production at this point. But I was separated from the movie from which I had separated so many other people. You know, it's like all revolutions eat their young. Well, I got eaten along with everything else. But by that point, my stamp had been on the movie. I had gotten it to where it achieved whatever it achieved, and at least it was a real film. You know, I had hired Paula Abdul and the Laker girls, the Lakerettes, to be the dancers, and quite a beautiful group of women and wonderful trapping for the show. We were ready to release the film through TriStar, and it tested well, and it worked well, and oh, you know, even the Running Man uniforms worked well. I guess the moral of this journey is that for me, it's much better to go to studios now and make projects with one place and instead of trying to keep 50, 60 investment elements balanced and happy.
And you know what happens then?
It was Andy who got in there and started the cameras turning, and Paul and all that Paul and I had learned and experienced in Miami Vice that gave this sort of visual style, of course, in great part by Tom Del Ruth, our great, wonderfully effective cinematographer.
I'll be back.
only in a rerun.
Go!
We were all very influenced, of course, by Blade Runner and by Ridley Scott and the English school of lighting and the general photographic style, smoke and backlight and xenons and mirrors and so on. Tom Del Ruth, a very fine cameraman, very fast, very knowledgeable. The production design was, I think, as good as it could be with the money that we had to do it with. I think that there's a slight cheesiness to the show, which really reflected what we thought game shows were like, that it's sophisticated, but there's just a little bit of cheeseball shit going all the way around it, including the dancers. But you say, okay, these are the dancers that entertain you at the Laker games, and the Laker games are held in an amphitheater. They're kind of gladiators who fight with a basketball, and periodically the sexy girls come out and jump around, and people love that. Paula Abdul was somebody that I had met as a choreographer and wanted to work with, and had no idea that she would become Paula Abdul, the musical singing, dancing sensation unto herself. At the time, she was a choreographer for the Lakerettes, and having gone to the basketball games, and I thought, well, all these quiz shows always had these, you know, and the June Taylor dancers, you know, it would be just great to have a bunch of sexy girls doing very hip dance on the show, and that was certainly some of the most entertaining days of shooting. So that combination of sort of theatricality, cheap, obvious sex, and violence or action is a combination that's been very much a winning formula. A lot of the ideas came from a combination of Andy Davis, who was there on the casting level. By the time Paul took over, we were cast. My sister, Jackie Birch, who had done many movies in this arena, including Commando and Die Hard. And so she had an eye for these comic book heroes. I mean, Dynamo was an opera singer, and you know, Professor Toro Tanaka, who was the hockey playing killer, Sub-Zero was a large odd job type of man.
Into quivering bloody sushi, Professor Sub-Zero.
We were talking about the action figures that came from Japan and the kind of crazy transformer robots that could become this or that. And we just kept thinking, Susan and I remember the day we started Breakthrough, that we didn't want guys in jumpsuits with high-powered rifles. We wanted guys with chainsaws and killed with electricity, and you know, we had all kinds of crazy ideas. These are the ones that made it, and we had them get names, like, so you could see that you're a kid in that time would want to collect all the action figures, you know, to get Buzzsaw and Dynamo or whatever, you know, all those guys. And we, you know, it was, that part was like some of the fun part of creating the movie. I wanted it to be a very plastic world.
The first squad. Let's go there now, live!
The movie was shot almost entirely on location in Los Angeles, and a huge segment of time out at the Fontana steel mills on the way to Palm Springs. which was a gigantic installation that had been demolished and was sitting there, and that's all these scenes of rubble and so on. The zone was really there primarily. There was an abandoned ice rink that's now been destroyed to make room for the Grove that we shot the ice skating sequence in. The rocket sleds were miniatures. There were a lot of sets, a great deal of sets, and more of that kind of thing than in actual real locations. I think whenever you're doing something in the near future, you're going to have to change so much out there in reality and keep cars and vehicles that don't belong. We shot at LAX, one sequence at LAX, but mostly stages or sets or the office building at Sony to be the network headquarters where Killian, you know, that huge lobby that's over at Sony. The idea of keeping it a show business movie and keeping it in L.A. really, really fit hand in glove. And I'm a big believer of shooting movies in the United States with American technicians. I'm not a big believer in running to Canada and other places. Because The Tonight Show and a lot of shows originate from L.A., it's sort of the home of television, and it was interesting that the game would be being played out very close to where Richard Dawson and the studio was, so that there was an immediacy that wasn't like it was happening 3 hours, you know, earlier in New York and the game was in L.A., or that it was a New York movie. I think the idea I had that there was a zone of a wasteland, an urban wasteland, fit L.A. better than it fit, you know, a high real estate cost place like New York City or Chicago. In the end, since Stephen came from D'Souza came from television, he'd been a major TV writer and producer, he knew this world really well. And when Arnold says, "I'll be back," and Killian, Richard Dawson, says, "Only in a rerun," that's a joke that could only have been written by a guy who grew up in TV and a kind of satirist that of great intelligence about TV and what we were doing here.
Hey, Killian! Here is Sub-Zero! Now,
and I think that Paul Michael Glazer and I, also being TV directors and, you know, feature directors, we had a feeling about the kind of Miami Vice glitziness that we wanted to bring to this, the colors and the not being afraid of color and keeping it in environments that were slick, you know, glass, stucco, neon, which, you know, we had used on Miami Vice and which had been largely evolved by Michael Mann and as a visual style, and we'd all started there and then gone off to do our own thing. But as you look at the sets, you can see the influences of a show like Miami Vice, which, you know, Paul and I had directed in that first year and saw that show sweep the country and become probably the largest success television had ever had up to then.
You want ratings, you want people in front of the TV sets instead of picket lines? Well, you ain't going to get that with reruns of Gilligan's Island.
I think Jackie and Andy had the idea of creating a pop culture kind of, you know, casting. I'm not always fond of that kind of casting. Because I think it just smacks of gimmicks that, you know, kind of take you out of the movie. But when you're doing a movie that is essentially about violence as show business, I thought that kind of Richard Dawson and Weasel and Fleetwood would give it this feeling that the good culture, the rock and roll culture, which has always stood for rebellion against society, anti-social kind of energy, was still alive and well. And although Mick's performance is a bit stiff and Dweezil's is, you know, understated, the fact that they were in the movie makes it all the more interesting all this time later. As we are here in the first week of the Second Persian Gulf War, and you begin to hear a phrase like militainment, like military entertainment, that people are glued to their TV, to CNN or other news shows, that the reporters that are on the site have become kind of like stars, you know, that the way the news has handled, the media has handled this war, the Iraqi war, has all the earmarks of a Hollywood production. It's a cast of thousands, it's hardware intensive, there's all sorts of visual effects explaining to you what a Scud missile does, or what a JDAM does, or Hellfire missile, or a Patriot missile. There's all sorts of renderings of the technical aspect of the war. Clearly they want to keep the shows moving, and you're talking to this one by cell phone, and then you're in the Northern Front. And it has all of this bizarre merger of television entertainment, but the entertainment is watching a real war. In a sense, Running Man is a paradigm of that. The idea was that you have an institutionalized attitude of a place where entertainment and true, real people intersect. In this case, the punishment of criminals in this somewhat coliseum-like environment of remote cameras and an audience of millions watching three men run for their lives, fighting it out against these strange gladiatorial comic book supervillains, and ultimately exposing the corruption and the truth about the game and the idea of using human beings for this kind of cruel entertainment. Whether it's the humiliation of some would-be singer on American Idol, or watching beautiful young women make complete fools of themselves fighting over a guy who they think is a millionaire, and people wanting their Andy Warhol 15 minutes on the stage, that they're willing to do anything. They're willing to straddle cable over a 2,000-foot drop. They're willing to be seduced or seduce a guy simply because they think he's rich, and because they're aware that every move they make, whether they take a shower with him or make out in the back of a limo, is being filmed, and that people who came off the first year of Survivor made a foray into this movie or that movie, some of the women I remember. It's not the high point of a Western civilization.
Uplinks, underground. Uplinks, underground. Guys, don't shut up, I'm going to uplink you.
And I think King, in his own crude way, and he wrote that when he was in college. The Richard Bachman books, I think, were some college writing of his that later got that he published under the pseudonym. I mean, I think he was seeing that. He was imagining that. He's always had the most incredibly fertile imagination, and although he implemented it in a more pedestrian way than we did, just guys with rifles chasing these criminals. No rocket sleds like we have here, no costumes, no zone, no, you know, none of the cyberpunk comic book trappings that D'Souza and I gave the story. But I think that the essence of it was really prescient, and that he saw the sort of insatiable appetite of television for anything that will entertain 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, now 1,000 channels clamoring to fill up their day. Of course, eventually, the very extreme things are going to become normal. Just as going to the Colosseum and watching guys fight to the death and betting on the Retarius, you know, this guy with the pitchfork and the net versus the guy with the sword and the little shield, and going, well, which is the superior equipment, you know, and having this interest in these things and watching people, you know, really killed in front of you for fun.
This is more important. It's the uplink, the network satellite.
So, in history, we've had it, you know, and Bachman / Stephen King was sort of putting it in a modern-day context. Then D'Souza and I put it in a more exaggerated, you know, colorful context. But, you know, when I look at what goes on in Survivor and other things, we weren't that colorful compared to what has come to pass. I think that Stephen King's novella was kind of noirish, and our whole take was very operatic cyberpunk. So King's story existed in a dark and very realistic world, and ours was truly theatrical and set in a near future that was truly the future. You know, that there was no question, if you watch any frames of this, you know it's not. Well, in 1985 or 86, when we started it, you would know it wasn't that world. Now it looks a little more like our world today. Gibson and Philip K. Dick, they were very influential on me for different reasons. Gibson, the whole cyberpunk genre that he coined, it was very refreshing to go, oh, this is just around the corner, right? I mean, it isn't about Star Trekian kind of gimmicks and beam me up and my mental mind control and all that. It was really like positing where society was going and how technology would impact on society. And we use the word technology today like every third word. At the time Gibson was writing Neuromancer, Burning Chrome, there was no real awareness of this new self-evolutionary thing called technology. And I believe this will be the core issue of the 21st century. Will not be a lot, the Iraqi war. Will be like the Industrial Revolution. It'll be something that appears clearly only after it has come to be. which is how does man manage the technology that he has created, when in fact the technology that he has created will now evolve faster than man, the creator.
Okay, Amber, I'm going to need you to remember these numbers. We got to get them to Mick and the Resistance.
All right, I will. Then let's go.
I'm developing a new movie called Warrior at Sony, which deals with the subject. And I know iRobot and other things are being planned around town or being shot even now. And I think it's really the filmic response to this anxiety of computers may begin to be based on biological algorithms that are self-evolutionary, that it can teach themselves, redesign themselves, that they can actually learn and grow. And once they learn and grow, when you're dealing with nanoseconds and further subdivisions of millionths and billionths and trillionths of a second, teroseconds, you really begin to see that the potential of technology to surpass us is coming. Since technology means the phone system, all our communication systems, the jets we fly, the public transportation we take, the credit card system that we rely upon, this is all part of technology that we have ceded to these machines and to that area of human development. Now, suddenly, we can't live without those things, the power plants and the telephone systems and so on. And when the computers begin to be self-evolutionary and have control of these things, we are going to have to deal with entities that William Gibson was imagining. And it's all happened probably faster than anybody imagined.
Come on.
I like that genre of science fiction literature because it's relatable, and that's why we did this, because everything in this movie is relatable. Nobody is flying around because they have mental control and anti-gravitational developments. The stunts are very real. The situations are very real. The villains are very comic book supervillains. The heroes are real heroes and basically realistic men and women within the context of this film. Again, it would be, you know, to this Stephen King story, what William Gibson was, you know, to his amplification of these ideas, that it would be sort of iconographic, that Arnold would represent the spirit of freedom and rebellion and its quest for truth, that the establishment would be mixed between politics and the media and there and a totalitarian state which had and enshrouded the country without people really being aware of how limited their liberties had become because they were so distracted by the narcotic of television. And like, here are these little floozy sexy cleavage flat tummy kind of girls, and ultimately there would be an underground that would rise up a la Spartacus. The slaves would take back the society and become free men. This may sound all very overblown for what the perception of the running man, but I assure you that's all that we were working on. Those were the ideas as simplistic and as perhaps in some aspects corny as we applied them, our dream in this movie was to take a look at the future society and to have the wonderful winning of the underdog and the morally correct and true over propaganda, lies, and mind control.
No. I won't kill a helpless human being. Not even sadistic scum like you.
You can't expect in a schematic morality tale of this kind that people are going to really get choked up by the death of Ben Richards at the end of the movie. That's good for King because the whole tone of his thing, as I said, was somewhat noirish and dark. And here it was important that all of the supervillains be brought to a suitable death and Arnold make the suitable one-liner after their death, the pun, you know, what a hothead, you know, or whatever.
Coughlin, break's over.
I'm going to wear, but not with you.
The film, like all movies developed by liberals such as myself, posits a fascist world where government and media are in charge of keeping the masses subdued and numb and feeling that life is going on normally when in fact it isn't. I don't think we've come that far, thank God, not yet, in our real society today. But I believe, for example, that Bush has used disinformation to keep the country completely paranoid. I think he's done it since 9/11 to get his agenda through. All these FBI terrorist alerts since 9/11 have not panned out. Their scale. It's an orange day. It's a yellow day. It's watch out on Long Island. I really believe that is a very diabolically conscious effort to keep the population terrified. So anytime they talk about we're doing this to get rid of terrorism, people go, great, because I'm sick of being afraid. Well, first you have to inculcate fear. You have to create it. And then you can assuage it by a war in Iraq, you know. And I believe that in that sense, what we were saying here with the government using sleight of hand, this TV show and other things like it, to keep the population distracted from the real problems, and an underground developing that wants to bust this conspiracy and bust this fascist hypnotic hold that it has on people, is that part is much closer to the truth than I would have ever thought back in 85.
You cold-blooded bastard. I'll tell you what I think of it. I live to see you eat that contract. But I hope you leave enough room for my fist because I'm going to ram it into your stomach.
I think this is something which we have to look at in our society. You saw Bowling for Columbine. I mean, one of the aspects that Michael Moore is at least positing as the reason for the increased violence in American society is the paranoia factor that keeps being created by the media. And yet, we're beginning to see a place where no matter how paranoid you are, they're digging deeper to find other fears for you to cope with, be it social ostracization on Survivor or, you know, back to Ultra Quiz, only done in the modern way, modern context. And I think that the movie was way ahead of its time and very, very accurate as to what was going to come. And That I think is definitely a bridge between King and reality programming today. I think that the effect reality programming has on the narrative perception abilities of the audience is that it's taking the Hollywood emphasis on plot and putting it on the reality television emphasis on character. Reality television is generally about people in a situation and who turns out to be good and who turns out to be bad. The tasks that they're asked to perform are just little hooks into keeping you interested in some sense of progress, but it's not like it's a beginning, middle, end, beat by beat, you know, almost the story model of, let's say, Charles Dickens, one of the most brilliant narrative writers of all time, where characters are introduced and no aspect of their presentation or life is just casual, that Magwitch will come back to be critical to Pip's future, you know, as his benefactor, that the plotting of these books, and of our sense of movies that's come from theater, come from novels and literature and come from theater to film, we have come to expect the plot to carry us along and carry us along at a very brisk pace. The reality television goes the other way. It goes, okay, here's this group of people and here they are on a date, you know, and here she's trying to get in his pants or impress him. And, or here's a group of people and we're in Thailand and some are on this team and some are on that team and they have to eat chunks of meat off of hanging haunch of meat. And we see which team chews as much meat in 30 seconds or 60 seconds. So meanwhile, that's just a template event so that people can scheme about who's no good and who they want to get rid of and all that. And there's a sense of you're seeing it, it's evolving, it feels quote unquote real and unrehearsed. That is very, very different than the Hollywood form of narrative where you're flowing with an idea but you have no illusion that this is the way life really works. It's life is not that pat, and you know, the gun isn't always in the desk drawer when you need it. It's not really an advanced visual effects film. I think the most complicated thing we did was the rocket sled and building that quarter scale and, you know, shooting it at 6 frames a second and, you know, kind of the standard miniature work. Bill Taylor and Sid Dutton at Illusion Arts, longtime collaborators of mine, did some beautiful matte work to create the zone and the sense of the big outdoor screens everywhere and so on. But in the end, the thing that made Running Man what it was is not the budget. We didn't have the budget for visual effects. It wasn't Blade Runner. We weren't, it wasn't Aliens. We weren't breaking that kind of ground. It was more the idea of the thematic elements of the film that made it different. And I think in retrospect special, because it actually, like William Gibson, has that a lot on its mind, as silly as some people might have thought it was, or as exploitational and violent, it really was looking at where American society was going. And we didn't know that 100% while we were constructing it, but we had a sense of that. We certainly weren't just stumbling upon, you know, these ideas. We really were trying to put them in the film, looking at the cultural indicators of 1985 to 1987. So I think that's what makes it, that's its greatest special effect, is it's actually a crazy movie with some really strong viewpoints and ideas. my love of Gibson and Stephen D'Souza's love of this entire comic book universe merged to create a movie which really was very sharp in its own way about predicting the trend of where we were headed. And I'm sure when the ratings of the Academy Award are lower than the finale of The Bachelor, well, things have changed. So rather than watching the same 50 glamorous faces get up and give or receive awards, people chose to watch a reality show as opposed to Hollywood awarding itself. And I think that's significant, because if they're not watching Joe Millionaire, they're watching CNN and the militainment that's rolling across the deserts of Iraq.
How about the life?
Arnold is an amazing person. He's a fully evolved person. He's got an incredible brain, tremendous business sense. He's got a big heart, wonderful family man, good father. And he is one of the truly most self-determined people that I've ever met. He decided what body he would have in those days in Austria. He decided how to take his career. What many people don't know is that he was a millionaire before he ever got onto film, because from his weightlifting and bodybuilding career and his connection to Joe Weider and products for people interested in bodybuilding, he had already become quite wealthy. And when he did Stay Hungry and began to move into the ranks of Hollywood feature films, it was all with a plan, which is why if Arnold became governor of California in the near future, I wouldn't be at all surprised, because he has a way of setting his mind to what he wants to do, and then he does it. And he has got that synchronicity with his time. Probably 10 years earlier, it might have been more of a struggle. But as physical fitness and a new level of violent films and the need for superheroes, which were so much larger than life and as to be almost unreal, he fit perfectly. The Terminator creation is one of the great screen personas, I believe, and Conan the Barbarian, perfect. So Arnold took a comic book sense of superheroes and made it come to life. But unlike some people who would do that and take themselves so seriously, there's always a twinkle in Arnold's eye. He's very sincere about what he's doing, but he knows that you know what he knows. And that is what makes him enduring, because there's no pretension about him. He knows what he can contribute, knows what he does well. It's wonderful that he does comedy so beautifully, like Twins and so on, and at the same time he can do action like Crazy. So to play the cold roboticness of the Terminator and to play the kind of warmth and sweetness of a movie like Twins, that's a wonderful range. And I think that there's a feeling that people have in watching Arnold that he's sort of like the American dream, that he came here, emigrated here, had ideas of what he wanted to do and achieved him, which is why possibly the gubernatorial race of the near future may see, you know, a man who really stands for what America's always been about, which is people with a lot of initiative and drive and talent coming to a country that allows them to find avenues for that initiative and rewards people regardless of their origins. So in every way, shape, and form, Arnold has created Arnold, and America and the world has embraced it because he's just downright entertaining. I think that Jesse and Arnold are always politically aware and interested. Of course, Arnold is married to a Kennedy, but is a Republican. And I always love that. I love that about their relationship with his relationship with Maria Shriver. I love it that two people could come from such totally different worlds and coexist without killing each other over polemics or political ideology. I think that actors become very, very known commodities to the audience. You feel like you know them. And it's not just movies. It's the media. It's Entertainment Tonight. It's Vanity Fair. It's the constant exposure of these people. And when a public feels that the person that they've come to know is admirable, they know this with a lot greater depth of certainty than with a political candidate who they might not have heard of the year before, or an incumbent governor, senator, whatever, who they've come to detest through his actions. So both with Jesse and Arnold, you feel that the audience was predisposed to liking them because they know so much about them, and then when it's applied to the political arena, if they handle themselves well, then you get this feeling of, I can trust that guy, I know who he is, I know what he stands for, I've watched him for 20 years as a movie star, and he's, you know, like I said, this self-made man. You get that substance to it. And it's ironic that both of them are in this movie, and they were, you know, they were good friends, or still are good friends, and how they communicate vis-a-vis politics and whether they agree. I'm sure Jesse has a lot of things to teach Arnold about running for governor of California, which I expect to see.
They need a leader. They need someone with experience.
I thought you were looking for the door.
I told Killian I'd be back. I wouldn't want to be a liar.
We didn't know it at the time, but, you know, some of these websites where people just, women or whatever, walk around their house all day and people watch there's a show on the Playboy Channel, Seven Lies Exposed, where apparently they have 38 or 78 cameras in this house, so everybody's behavior, sexual or eating lunch or whatever, is always being filmed from several angles. There's shows like Taxi Cab Confessions, where the cabs are rigged with lipstick cameras and lipstick lenses, so that, you know, they get many angles on the same thing unfolding. Combined with Orwell, with Big Brother, and the idea that with our further developed communications technology, we will be able to sort of keep an eye on things. Your cell phones can be traced. In other words, your cell phone is a marker of where you are in space, because they can get it off which cells you're using. There are cookies implanted in websites. So if you access a website, even if you don't log on or become a member, they know who came in to look around.
Mr. Spock, you have the comm.
Who's Mr. Spock?
The government has the ability to do anything mild, like that seems almost natural now. These cameras at cross sections and the streets that will photograph you running a red light or making an illegal turn, and it's not that far from that to the next stage where there are cameras in people's offices, and there's cameras in the lobbies of buildings, there's cameras in 7-Elevens, there's cameras in department stores, there's, God knows, in Vegas casinos. I mean, the idea of unilateral surveillance is no longer like what Orwell was writing about, the reaction that that book got in its time. It's like, wow, that could never happen. You know, we're not going there. Well, we are going there. We're just slipping there very, very smoothly.
3, 2, 1. We got it.
I think that, again, computerization allows access to information in a much easier way. Before, you'd have to go rifle some guy's filing cabinet, break into his house, and, you know, to get his private stuff. Now we carry our private stuff around with us in airports, and we have wireless internet connections, and those rays, those microwaves, can be captured, and people could basically read what you're writing, and you could be writing a report about something important to your company that might be interesting to other companies, or you could be writing a pornographic letter to some, you know, pen pal you have. Our technology creates greater communications opportunities, but it also creates vulnerabilities to privacy. And I think if the Bush philosophy were to prevail, which I truly hope it won't, the idea of a citizen's right to privacy, which is not really protected in the Constitution, which has evolved in case law over the years, that could get eroded. Because just as they can reinterpret the abortion rulings of the Supreme Court, they can reinterpret the many, many precedents of citizen privacy, especially if we get ourselves into economic or military crisis where the Patriot Act could begin to inhibit what people say, just like the Alien and Sedition Acts after the Revolutionary War were used to quiet opposition. I believe that eternal vigilance is the price of liberty, and we should be very vigilant against this encroachment, because I feel it all around, and now it's able technologically to be imposed in a way that was never before possible.
What's the matter now, bitch? Why aren't you laughing?
Because there's nothing funny about a dickless moron with a battery up his ass.
Of course, Orwell was, you know, it was one of the most powerful books that I had ever read. And I wanted this film to reflect a kind of fascistic vision, you know, anesthetize the population and keep an eye on them at all times. And any seeds of rebellion or dissension would be eradicated immediately. Although I don't think Stephen D'Souza and I were totally aware of where things were going. We were throwing around these ideas as to the kind of society that would be a great context for the Running Man. Because making this game acceptable depended on its being in a context where you'd say, okay, I buy that, it's the Colosseum. Anesthetize the masses, keep them distracted. And how better than a mass consumption game that millions of people would tune into all the time, and it would be a cross between football and a quiz show and, you know, game show and a life and death hunt and super villains chasing heroes, you know, underdogs. So I think to that degree we were aware, and sometimes because he and I are both techno kind of guys, I think we were absorbing where things were going. I think I'm the first person who ever wrote a screenplay on a computer, and Mark Twain was the first guy to write a novel on a typewriter, and I bought that first IBM 64K computer when it, and wrote several scripts for Warner Brothers when word wrap was the only reason that that was any way superior to a Selectric, IBM Selectric. And so I've always been interested in technology, and so has Stephen. And this was really a reflection of our liberal horror or nightmare of a fascistic world that could come to be.
Well?
I got to score some steroids.
The film was very successful, not with critics who were appalled by its level of violence. I mean, that year it was voted, there's some award, or, you know, it's a negative award, but for the most violent movie, and we won that year. And now you look at the film, and it's the idea that this would be considered the most violent film of a year and be pretty much trashed for its offensiveness and its, you know, lack of connection to film critics only shows me once again that anytime you do anything that's sort of really prescient or ahead of its time, it will not be understood by the establishment that writes about it. It did fine. It was profitable. I don't think it swept along. I thought that the irony is that when you have an output deal with a company like TriStar, which wasn't the strongest distributor to begin with at that time, and their profit ability is so diminished because you've sold off HBO, you've sold off Europe, you've sold off everything, and they're basically distributing it for a fee, well, you become a stepchild to their own internally generated movies. So I felt that the ad campaign was pathetic, that I look at the poster on my wall now and go, what was black and white, and what was anyone thinking? But I wasn't there at that point to protect the film. But in spite of everything, it did well. How well, I don't really recall. The numbers never really quite made it to me anyway.
Well, that hit the spot.
It's a film that wears better with age, even than at its time. At its time, it might have seemed completely over the top and crazy. And now, in the context of, as we've been discussing, reality shows and technological despotism, you know, it begins to look much, much better. And it was also obligatory that the revolution prevails and Arnold's character is cleared of crimes and that the public wakes up to how they're being manipulated. That was the only possible hopeful ending. Richard Dawson is sent on his little rocket sled to his death. And Maria Conchita Alonso, our romantic lead, and Arnold, our romantic hero lead, should walk down freely down the halls of the network, kissing. It seemed like an appropriate act of rebellion. The Running Man, we were ahead of the curve, and it was, in fact, an idea whose time was about to happen. American Gladiator ripped us off totally, and had I thought of moving The Running Man on TV in some form, it would have made more money than it did as a theatrical feature. But television has evolved much more quickly towards this sort of level of hideous theatricality in, well, I guess, what people now are calling reality programming, Survivor, Fear Factor, The Bachelor, Joe Millionaire. I mean, the list goes on, and there's more every season. And it's sort of nauseating. We were doing it as a satire of what might happen. The fact that truth has become replaced satire as a reality, and reality programming is in fact one step away from watching executions on, you know, cable access or your DirecTV, you know, tune up your TiVo to executions across the country, and you could be watching people electrocuted and death by injection or hanging or whatever they're doing in the United States. That's not so far-fetched when you watch people humiliate each other and do all sorts of sexual things and all sorts of violent things and all sorts of antisocial things for money. Watching people on Survivor cut each other's throats and trap people, and the cruelty of voting them out, or the cruelty of American Idol, watching people who put their talent out in a very naked way being totally humiliated by whom? What's that guy got to offer? And so you say, well, here we are. You know, the film was released in 87, so we're 16 years later, and television has become very much like what we predicted back in the mid-80s when Reagan was king, Junk Bonds and Mike Milken were gods, and people thought they were masters of the universe. Today we know that is not true. But the movie stands as a testament to a state of mind, not only in what's on the screen, but what went on behind the screen. I think that The Running Man is emblematic of a certain kind of filmmaking that went on at a certain time in Hollywood. It's very place-specific and time-specific. I'm glad that I fought all through all the directors and all of the drafts of the script and all of the machinations to get it made, because I think that it might be looked upon more interestingly with hindsight than it was in its own time. And that always, in a funny way, delights me, being perverse, that I would rather have a film of mine seem more interesting in later years than be hot in the year it comes out and then quickly forgotten, and years later people look at it and go, why did that do so well? That was, you know. I think in some ways The Running Man's been seminal. I think that a lot of reality television and a lot of the kind of theatrical mayhem that followed in terms of shows like American Gladiator and right on to Survivor and other things today, there is a connection to the sensibility that was in The Running Man. And as a filmmaker, both producer and director, the things that I really love to find are the ideas that will, you know, transcend it, their opening Friday night. And of course, with films like The Fast and the Furious and Triple X, I've had that great opening Friday night, and I hope the films sustain. But with The Running Man, we've now had almost two decades to look at it, and watching it today and remembering all of the intent, I feel that it's a film that deserves more than just a little footnote in history, and actually was foundational to a whole sensibility that is now the state of the art. I'm really proud of it, because it's sort of a little bit of cultural iconography that was amazingly prescient.
I'm Bill Hilden. Good night and take care.
Well, we've made it alive into the zone and out. This has been your game show host, Rob Cohen. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the journey.